Accession number 6930, rule number 4.
General Moulton, rule 4. Having defined the needs of amphibious warfare in your own mind and worked out what you required to deal with the various problems, how did you go about having your ideas accepted by the Chiefs of Staff?
Well, as we say, we had now to get the Chiefs of Staff to put their backing behind the financial provision for rebuilding an amphibious lift. I must remind you, as I said before, that the three service ministries were more powerful single entities in those days than they were after the reformations of the mid-1960s. At first, I was working with the vice chiefs of naval staff who handled the question of amphibious warfare. And each time I submitted a paper, in fact, I couldn't submit a paper to them. The joint planners were instructed to write a paper, and I had to make my presentations through the joint planners. And this, frankly, was getting nowhere. And it was fairly obvious also that I wasn't going to get anywhere the vice chiefs, because however intelligent and interested the vice chiefs might be, it seemed fairly clear to me that on this problem at least they couldn't override the briefs, their ministerial briefs, the ministry's briefs. I meant the ministry, not the political side of it, that their staff side, the planner's side, the directorate of plans, if you like, in the Navy, and equivalent directorates in the other services, headquarters, which formed the joint planning section of the Chiefs of Staff. So I really had one problem, was to raise it above the level of the chiefs, of the vice chiefs, and then to persuade the chiefs to override some of their own service advisors.
Two-stage process.
Yep. And I must emphasize that none of the three services are really vitally concerned. The Navy were the first to get interested. The Army were rather indifferent about it. And the Air Force were frankly hostile because they believed that any modern intervention would be done as a completely airborne operation. Well, I had, as I say, I prepared the modern design. I got people to prepare for me modern design sketches. And at the end of 2 years, I found I was getting absolutely nowhere. I felt as time had come for me, if I couldn't do better than this, to retire and finish with this all. Just to explain my situation a little more, I believed that there was a need for amphibious rebuilding the amphibious lift, but I prepared to accept that that was only my opinion. But what I could not tolerate was the idea of good officers and men being continually employed and equipped with thoroughly out of date and dangerous equipment. Dangerous not admittedly from the from accident, but from if they went to war it would be dangerous. And so therefore I felt the Chiefs of Staff must take a decision either to give up amphibious warfare altogether, which I would be against my advice, but I would not say it was definitely wrong, or to rebuild the amphibious lift. And that was my problem.
So your idea was you either do it properly or you don't do it at all?
Yes, exactly. I said I would say do it properly, but if somebody else said don't do it at all, that would be sound. But I said go on fooling around like this is definitely wrong and is indefensible. Okay. However, knowing what I wanted to do and being able to do it are two different things. Luckily, at the time, among the Chiefs of Staff advisors, there were a number of people I knew. I'd been in my Cambly course in 1938. There was General Stratton, who's now Vice Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And to Roddy McLeod, General McLeod, who was Deputy Chief of Defence Staff, and in fact my correct approach to the Chief of Defence Staff if I had any matter to raise. And I pointed out to each in turn that we've got nowhere in 2 years. In fact, even longer than 2 years, because we're still dithering on amphibious lift before I arrived in my appointment.
What was the problem? Was it that they couldn't decide whether they wanted to or not?
They wouldn't make a decision anyway.
Why wouldn't they make a decision?
Well, it's very easy, I suppose, on a subject like that to defer it to another meeting. I think you would look up the records, you'd find that periodically this question was coming up. First of all, over to my predecessor's idea of the LCT-9, then over my own ideas, and each time they would tell the joint planners to write a paper on it, and each time they wouldn't accept the paper, partly on my advice.
They would just send the paper back.
Yeah. And so I said, well, now look, for 2 years the joint planning staff have failed to produce a paper which you've agreed to. Now will you let me do it? And each in turn, Roddy McLeod and Bill Stratton said, okay, that seems reasonable. So I then went to Caspar John, who was the Vice Chief of Naval Staff then, and I got to know quite well when I was at Portsmouth, and he was Flag Officer Air. I put the same proposition to him, and Caspar John was a man of moves, but he agreed to this. So then I tackled the airman. I can't remember his name at the moment. Now, the air staff had always been really the nigger in the woodpile, in that they had continually prevented us coming to any decision. I don't know why they wouldn't go for the full decision, perhaps of abandoning the idea. They didn't. And really, of course, with three of the other vice chiefs against him, he had to agree. So I produced my paper. And about that time, certainly at that time, Charles Lamb was First Sea Lord. Now, he'd been a CNC Mediterranean at the time of Suez, and it so happened that many of the LSTs and LCTs they took out of unmaintained reserve had been very unseaworthy when took them over. And in fact, some of the LCTs had lost their rudders. They dropped off. Charles Lamb, I never corrected him on this point, but he seemed to remember that the LSTs had dropped their rubbers, which would be more serious. And I can remember him being his other chiefs of staff times. So he was a convert to the idea. So by this time, the Navy were behind the idea. We'd got with Henry Roaf, we had got them to accept the idea of the sharp-bowed assault ship. So we were now really ready to, so I wrote my paper. Now, I can't get the events necessary in correct time order after this length of time. I don't think I've got any records. You could explore the cross papers, I suppose, if you, but somewhere about now, President Lord Watkinson, who was then Mr. Watkinson, had become Secretary of State for Defence, relieving Duncan Sands. And he very courteously, when I offered to call on him, accepted my call. And he seemed interested in what I had to say. And as I took my leave of him, I said, I wonder if you would like my staff to arrange a little presentation of what I've been telling you. And he thought a moment, he said, yes, I would. Well, of course, once the news got round Whitehall that amphibious warfare giving a presentation for the Secretary of State, all the crowned heads had to attend. We worked very hard at this presentation. We took half an hour. We timed ourselves for half an hour. We gave 10 minutes on what we've got now. And we put in the middle 10 minutes on what the Americans have got. Now, I had a United States Marine Corps colonel on my staff, I forgot to mention earlier, who was a very impressive figure. I knew they gave a very good presentation to their staff. And then we finished up with 10 minutes on what we could have. which was really my paper I prepared with chiefs of staff. It went. I knew that Admiral Mountbatten didn't like people speaking from notes, so I arranged that everybody rehearsed on a machine like this until they were word perfect on their part. And you've got to do that to get that amount of stuff through in half an hour. As we left, Charles Lamb took me by the elbow and said, "Putting that Marine Corps colonel on was a stroke of genius." And this is the fact, you see, the chiefs of staff were simply unaware of the modern state of the technology of amphibious warfare. And we were now in, shall we say, 1959, and they were thinking still in terms of what they'd seen in 1944.
15 years behind the times.
Not only that, but 15 years of peacetime development. Remember that 1944 was a very much a hothouse plant. They we'd started in 1940 with pretty well nothing, and we'd formed with tremendous drive and energy on part of very many people these great amphibious forces which have culminated in Normandy. But the doctrine was very immature in those days. If I went and analysed some of the amphibious stuff that went on, you'd be horrified. But it worked, and that's what you do in wartime. But it was no well considered doctrine. A mature doctrine. So we were still back there, and Korea and all that had passed them over. They were just in their own Navy, Army, Air Force, and amphibious warfare had stayed back where it was in the rushed developments of 1944.
Had there been no study of the Incheon landings then?
No.
Why not?
We've been in America.
Well, why haven't they been studied?
Well, nobody was interested. When you say I will boast for myself, I knew about them because we had a certain number of Marine Corps colonels over in this country. I suppose it was a predecessor to mine. Mine was Colonel Drake, but we had a chap called Robert Heinel, who subsequently wrote a very fine history of the Marine Corps, and he had given me a book long before I was Portsmouth called "The U.S. Marine Corps and Amphibious Warfare," which is a very professional historian's account of the Pacific War. I was also a devotee of Admiral Morrison's official history of Pacific War of the United States Navy. So I can claim that I was almost unique, I should say, in being very interested in what the Marine Corps, American Marines were doing. There must have been others, but they weren't getting the proof of the pudding in the eating. They weren't getting the chiefs of staff, who really, I think, were completely taken aback by this presentation of what the American Marines were doing. I think this was really the turning point. I put it down to the fact we had got Mountbatten, perhaps first, as Chief of Defence Staff now, and he had now come to the conclusion we did need something more than the LPHs. We had got Watkinson, who was receptive and courteous to people with new ideas. We had Charles Lamb, who everyone admires very much, and who's a great asset to the Admiral. He's a wonderful First Sea Lord, much better than his predecessor. It was Mountbatten. No, I wouldn't say that, no. I think he was an earlier predecessor. We had broken. I'd broken through to the chiefs of staff and the vice chiefs. Well, I had the impression that certainly the vice chief of the air staff didn't dare depart from his brief. Now, the chief of the air staff died in the wool light blue, fighter pilot Dermot MacPar. Dermot Boyle, I think he was then, at least wasn't dominated by his brief. We had Frankie Festing, who had commanded the 29th Independent Brigade in Diego Suarez Landing, so he knew something about amphibious warfare as CIGS. And Charles Lamb as First Sea Lord, Mountbatten as Chief of Defence Staff. Well, we got the sort of committee that might get something done like that.
Sounds as though you had something rather akin to the astrologer's favourable.
With one?
It's rather like the astrologer's favourable conjunction of friendly planets.
Yeah. I suppose also, as one does get senior in the services, you do find you meet many of our old friends again you haven't seen for years. So by the summer of 1960, I would normally have been due to retire in October 1960. I think we had more or less agreement on what we ought to do. I'm not sure. I think even we had the Admiralty may have ordered the long-term components of the assault ships, but they hadn't. We hadn't got the assault ships or the logistic ships into the estimates. So I put in for a year's extension to get them into the estimates, and really things were now going our way. And I don't really recollect any more difficulty. One had to keep on at it. One kept in close touch with the director of movements for logistic ships. We brought in my naval advisors. I should have said earlier, I now got a chief staff officer who had been captain of one of the OST-3s in the amphibious warfare squadron. Captain Dan Reuter, who was a tremendous asset in this. In fact, I had a very good staff working under me in all three services. They'd got into the habit of a three service attitude. They were happy to go into soldiers to go into the Admiralty and sailors to go into the war as required, and were fully behind this scheme. We had a very good wing commander as our airman. He still rather hankered after the all-air operation, but he was on the whole, I think he was very rapidly coming round to view. I remember talking it over with him once. I said, if you could produce an aircraft which would produce anything like the lift of an LCL and land reasonably slowly, perhaps I would agree to. And not to take it quite to the extremes, I meant a group, shall we say, of aeroplanes that perhaps could carry the load of an LSL. After all, that's 15 centurions to begin with, and then you put a lot of lorries on top of that, and about 400 soldiers as well. The point is that the Hercules, even, which wasn't, we hadn't got then, cannot produce that sort of lift.
Wasn't there ever any idea that perhaps the two forces, the airborne intervention force and the sea lifted force, might act in conjunction?
Well, yes, and I perhaps inadvisedly I put on paper an idea of my own in that last year, and I sometimes wish I hadn't done it, that we should amalgamate AWHQ with whatever supposed to run airborne forces. You see, there was a very different setup there. Their doctrine was largely developed for them about Old Sarum. Well, I don't think that's sound. I don't think Cambly can really pretend to dictate the policy for the whole of the army. It was a sort of larger scale, the same thing. There was a very pleasant Air Vice Marshal there. We got on very well with them, but. There's a very difference. It's very difficult to get them moving on new ideas. They were still really thinking terms purely of airborne forces, and I suggested we should be amalgamated with something corresponding. And in fact, I think for a short time, an airman relief, my relief didn't last very long. A year or two, there was a very bright vice marshal came in. I remember he was quoted before he'd taken over that job when I was still there. My wing commander came back and told me about this chap, and this airman had said to him, well, to my mind, your AWHQ I'd all be abolished or combined with us. And I agreed. Unfortunately now, perhaps I feel guilty that perhaps because I produced a paper saying we should be combined with airborne, and it had led to in the end, disappearance of AWHQ, but there were an awful lot of long knives after out of HQ long before I went there. Again, the great barons of the three service ministries didn't like an intermediary like this. I think that really is all the story. I would like to emphasize perhaps the main heads of the policy. Well, first was that we weren't trying to repeat Normandy. We must forget a lot of the ideas there. The thing was nothing on that scale. What we were trying to do was to land, to land a military force in a fighting posture, against, if necessary, opposition, but not necessarily against opposition. I had a picture in my mind of what I saw in Alexandria when the mace fences went there. A sort of chaos in the docks while everything was hoisted out of ships. I mean, even if you're going to a foreign port, it's much better if you can drive out of your ships in your vehicles ready to go into battle. And in the temper of modern intervention, that's what you've got to do. So I was talking not about Normandy or invasion, but about landing a balanced self-contained force in a fighting posture. Secondly, I said we must forget about short-range operations. There may be short-range operations in the future, but they're not worth the money on the lift. We've got to have a lift which, as a rule of thumb, I said should be able to get round the Cape of Good Hope and intervene in the Indian Ocean. At a reasonable steaming speed. And finally, to return to your point, which I did make in those days, that every operation should be regarded as a seaborne airborne operation, and each, the airlift and sea lift, should each do what they can do best. And the characters are very different, but together they offer a much wider range of possibilities and options than either do separately.
One point that I would like to ask you is how long you thought it would take to actually produce the sort of lift capability that you wanted.
Well, the ships, I think, were coming into, were being commissioned. The first to be commissioned was the Sir Lancelot. And then they ordered the other five after her. And the first of the assault ships was the Fearless. And I think by 1965, those first two were in commission. And in the course of the 1960s, the rest were built.
So it was about 5 years after you had your policy accepted.
They got in 1961 estimates, yes. It takes that time to build a ship these days.
And you say that after the presentation, the opposition more or less faded away. How did the opposition manifest itself before you managed to overcome it?
Well, I think by a continual one would almost say strangling each project at birth, usually in the joint planners. And if not in the joint planners, I suppose there must have been financial considerations. We didn't deal direct with the financiers at AWHQ.
Through the chiefs, did you?
Well, the money was found, you see, by the ministries, not by the three service ministries, not by the Minister of Defence.
Did you find out what sort of arguments the joint planners actually used to strangle these projects, other than the financial?
Well, the other one was that this is the aftermath of Suez. Suez got amphibious warfare a bad name because of that. I suppose, above all things, that long delay between the airborne landings. Remember, they seized that airfield at Port Said, and then nothing happened. And in fact, they were bombing Cairo or something, but still, poor old amphibious warfare squadron and all these ships they'd taken up from trade were chugging along slowly from Malta.
So the argument then was that amphibious operations were inherently difficult and slow.
That's right. And not modern in outlook. They didn't look modern. As I say, airlift was judged by the calendar sent out by the air manufacturers, and we were judged by what the chief of staff remembered of 1944.
It really was a matter of public relations.
Well, it isn't public relations so much as service relations. Well, of course, we had no public relations branch, and you see, there again, who were the Ministry of Defence public relations shouting for? Not for us, certainly.
Did anyone ever use the argument against you that any sort of amphibious force would be vulnerable to atomic attack?
Yes, and yes, they did. It so happens they did teach a sort of at School of Amphibious Warfare at Flemington. They did do something with an atomic attack in it, and it wasn't very convincing. And I remember saying at Camberley one day, "Well, you say that an amphibious landing against atomic attack doesn't make sense. Do you really think an infantry attack makes sense, or an armoured attack?" Applying different criteria, different standard of criticism, all of conventional operations, as we call them, still call them perhaps improperly, look pretty impractical against atomic or nuclear attack. But you apply this to amphibious warfare, you don't apply it to your one single service operations.
When the estimates were presented, did they encounter any opposition in the House of Commons?
I honestly can say I did take a considerable interest in what was said. I don't think they did. They must have had a little bit. Undoubtedly, people in the House of Commons have thought it was terribly antiquated to land both from the sea at all.
Was there any? I was thinking more in terms of people accusing you of planning a revival of gunboat diplomacy.
I don't think there was much talk of that, really. No, I think on the whole it was the idea that we hadn't got a modern look. And indeed we hadn't until we got the new ships.